This episode was made possible by our incredible patrons who faithfully support the work of amplifying the voices of spiritual abuse survivors. We are an extremely small team comprised of just two families with a passion for stories and image bearers. We committed early on to not monetizing any of the stories and rely solely on the donations of our Patreon community to operate. If you value this work and are able to contribute, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Another way you can support us is by following, rating, and reviewing the podcast. It only takes a moment, but it has a big impact on our reach. Thank you for daring to listen. Before we begin, we want to make the listener aware that this episode contains adult content related to abuse, sexual assault, and/or suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to our two-part series featuring storytellers Aaron and Joyce. On episode one, we featured Aaron's story. If you haven't had a chance to listen to it, I encourage you to do so before listening to today's episode, which will be Joyce's story. I'm Jay Coyle, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
I am all about blessed subtraction. There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus. And by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop.
All right, welcome back, everyone. We are excited to have Joyce on the podcast with us today. Joyce is the life partner of Aaron, who we featured previously, probably the week prior or the day before this you're listening this episode. So we are really excited to talk to Joyce. It's been an honor to get to know both of them, and we're honored to be able to share Joyce's story. So Joyce is going to be sharing a little bit about her childhood and her time at college, and talking more in depth about her experiences in college and after college. So, Joyce, welcome to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate that.
Well, we are thrilled to talk to you. I was going to kick us off with just a quick kind of intro into what we want to talk about, and then you can take it from there. We'd really love to understand, before we kind of get into your experience with the college you were at, which was a Christian college in Indiana that you attended with Aaron. We'd really love to know a little bit more about your childhood and your upbringing. You know, what was the faith like? What were faith experiences like as a child? Did you go to church? What was the dynamic within the home when it came to faith? If you could expand on some of those topics, that would be super helpful.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I grew up in the hills of Western Pennsylvania, like on the highest point in Pennsylvania, on a farm, which was like 30 minutes away from anywhere. And my father was a pastor, later bishop, they use that title still, in the Conservative Mennonite Conference when they were still very conservative.
Can you explain just like a tiny bit of what that is?
Absolutely.
Because I think a lot of people might not even have anywhere to put that in their brain. Okay. Like, what is that?
So the Conservative Mennonite Conference is Anabaptist in their teachings, very peace-oriented, very to the point of a story is told of an ancestor who kicked the guns out of his children's hands when they were defending themselves against an attack. And they ended up, several of them were killed, several of them were taken. But it's just the non-resistance is extreme. And then also, they, at the time, and I don't believe the conference is as conservative anymore, you took things literally. Like, I wore my hair up with a covering. I wore a dress all the time, which doesn't lend itself well to farming. But that's another conversation. And then to church, I would have to wear a cape dress, which was like you have another piece of material from your shoulder to your waist as just another part of modesty is how they would see it. there was no wearing. You could wear in the winter, we could wear jeans under a skirt. That's how I used to hunt because I grew up. We had to fill our freezer. That's how we ate. And so it was a very peaceful from the outside. A lot of people view it a lot of times as this miraculously forgiving community. They're just always amazed at how people forgive, how people are non-resistant, and but they don't understand the unhealthiness that's behind that. And so I would say it's a very simple belief. At the time, it was always more about we, the community, versus I, the individual, which meant that there was a lot of community help. You know, we did barn raids. A barn would burn down one day, 2 days later, you'd have a fully operational barn again. People watched other people's children constantly. It was just a very intertwined community. So my father was the pastor. I feel I was fortunate that my father, having spoken with other individuals my age, my father was a unique pastor in that being non-resistant, he did his what they called the 1W service where he got the exemption. And he actually worked at the Norristown Psychiatric Hospital. And that was he was there the first time they brought the first psychotropic drugs in. So he spoke about how he saw individuals who previously were unable to just hardly exist, all of a sudden become viable human beings, all of a sudden be able, you know, have thoughts and things. So I think his experience that he had there made him much more empathetic. It had gotten him out of the community. He interacted with the world. He understood mental health. In ways that many of them don't. And so I feel very fortunate that my father had that experience because I think, honestly, it's why I and my family, to some degree, was very different. I grew up, of course, I had to wear the covering. So I decided I'd become an authority on 1 Corinthians 11. And so my dad and I would sit around. It wasn't unusual. Sunday afternoons, we'd have the concordances out, we'd have the Greek Bible out, we'd have the, you know, and we'd be sitting there discussing scripture. And I always refer to it as, it reminds me a lot of the movie Yentl. I don't know if you've ever seen that, where as a female, I shouldn't have been doing certain things. I should not have been studying scripture. I should not have been going this in depth. And yet it was my father who introduced me to that and who was my, my mentor in learning scripture and allowed me to question, allowed me to really go in depth on a lot of the study. And so I really appreciate that. I grew up in a church where the women sat on one side, men on the other. I remember when my sister started first sitting with her husband, it was like a scandal, you know, this. And so, you know, I think they've gotten away from that pretty much now, but it was very conservative. It was the triune communion of foot washing, the cup and the bread. And it was a very, what I would call fairly solid. You didn't see a lot of, it was interesting for me when I went into Assemblies of God or went into different traditions where people would just like randomly pray for people. It's like we had prayer meetings Wednesday night for that, you know, and so it's just a very, you lived out your faith more than what you really spoke it. We didn't have daily devotions. We didn't have daily prayer. Like if someone was sick, there might be prayer beside the bedside. But it was a pretty practical faith. Any kind of spiritual warfare was only considered as happening over someone's heart as to whether they would, you know, follow Christ or not. And it was never, that was a thing that when I got to college, it was kind of new to me, that this whole spiritual warfare. But I'm very fortunate to have been born into that community. I'm very thankful for a lot of the things in that community. One of the things, though, however, because there's lots of silence in the community, right now it's not as much, but there was a lot of isolation. And so I am a child survivor of multiple individual perpetrators in the Plain community. I did have one repeat abuser that was throughout my teenage years. They were all known to me, family, some way connected. I am not abnormal. In my generation from that area, I think I found three who have not experienced that. So it really, and it's generational. You can go back generations. And so that's something I'm working with right now, of trying to break that isolation, trying to break that silence. But this is what I grew up with. This is what I dealt with, and we never spoke about it. It was understood. Even if it was known, it was understood. You did not speak about it. The only thing, if someone offered an apology, you were expected to forgive and forget. I did not speak about it with anyone at all until I went to Bible Institute, which is another tangent. But I did, the other thing that my parents did for me, which I'm really appreciative of, is there was a Christian school started in the community. My parents refused to let me go. And so in our public school, which wasn't that big, but in our public school, I was the only one wearing a covering and wearing a dress. And so I always had that feeling of not quite fitting in, because I didn't quite fit in there. I didn't fit then in with our youth group, because they all attended the same school and I did not. Like I said, though, looking back, I'm extremely thankful my parents did that for me. It opened doors that otherwise would not have been opened for me. But it was just kind of an isolating. I had my friends. My best friends were guys, because I couldn't do the makeup. I couldn't do the clothes. Even though it was the wonderful 80s with all the bright colors and big hair, you know, it was just, I could connect with the guys on the intellectual, creative level. And so there were a few of us that were a really close group. But then there were also guys, they were not from the playing community. And so I never spoke to them about it at all either. When I graduated, I had a full ride to Penn State main campus. But in my tradition, at least at that time growing up, you were not an adult until you were 21. So all your costs were paid for, medical, dental, everything until you were 21. And I was told that I was not allowed to go. They would only pay if I attended this specific Bible Institute. And so I'm very different now than what I used to be. I used to be extremely compliant. And so I went and I had a year there, learned a lot of Bible, made some good friends, still have contact with some of my friends from then. But then I came back home, having lost the scholarships, of course. And this does play into my going to college. I worked for 2 years to save to go to college. My parents were not going to help me. They did not have the money. And my mother, women just did not get higher education. And so even the week that I left for college, she told me she did not think I was mature enough to leave. I understand that, though. Her fear was of me leaving the faith, which my dad knew was going to happen, but my mom really did not want to happen. But I worked really hard to get to this college in Indiana. I still remember being on the phone, you know, begging for more aid, because I was like so thousands of dollars short. And I worked so hard to get there. And up to this point, on another tangent to get to college, is when I was 9 years old, I was run over by a car, backed over by a car and drug. I actually had an out-of-body experience, and my dad and I talked about it later. That could be a separate thing, but he verified then later that, yes, my actions showed that I was aware of stuff going on they thought I was out for. I had been drugged like 300 yards. The tire, I remember the tire to my right, the muffler to my left before my head hit back. We had a tiny, tiny hospital in the rural middle of nowhere. And so they did x-rays and kept me for 3 days observation. Looking back, I'm sure I had a concussion. Like, there's no doubt in my mind.
That's it, though?
Yeah. Like, there were no bones broken. It was completely miraculous that I lived. Yeah. But what it did give me, it gave me what it's called thanatophobia, which is death anxiety. Because I still remember that moment when my head snapped back and hit the the bar of the car before it knocked me out. And so back then, I always had this fear, this anxiety of death. I had never had a panic attack. That's another important thing. Before I went to college, I did not have panic attacks. I would say that I had a suicidal ideation, but but the death anxiety kept me from doing anything about it. I was like,
it's like a catch 22.
Exactly. But
two bad things, but they were working for some sort of
safety. Keep me alive. Yeah. Until.
Yes.
So I get to college. I've never had a panic attack. I've worked really hard to get there. My first year, I wore a covering and dresses still because I was not yet 21. It was a great year. I made a lot of friends. I was excited. Higher education. You know, hanging out with the musicians, you know, watching the piano players practice and just all the, you know, the physics lab. I was majoring in physics and just a lot of exciting things. And so the second year I'd come back and I was 21 now. And at the time I was a lot more chicken than what I am now. So I called from the college and told my mom that I wanted to ask for my church letter. And that's what they call it when you leave the church at that time. You had to get a church letter saying you were in good standing to leave the church and you no longer came under the rules of the church. It's changed a lot. Back then, like, you couldn't have musical instruments in church. So we all know four-part singing. You couldn't have photography, just a lot of different rules. So of course I wanted out from under that. And so I asked for my church letter. My dad, of course, was not surprised. My mother was heartbroken. Again, that was no surprise. They agreed to give my church letter. And at that point, then I no longer wore a doily or a covering. We used to call the little white lace ones doilies. Those were not allowed in my home community. I gave up any kind of covering. I started wearing jeans and pants. It's the first time in my life I've done that in public. And
was that like the most freeing thing?
It was
like,
amazing.
I can run so fast.
It was amazing.
So fast.
Yeah. And it used to always crack me up. You wear dresses for modesty, but I'm unloading hay wagons full of hay bales. I am milking cows. I am schlepping out, you know, the mud and the dirt. All in a dress. Like, I'm out there shoveling snow in a dress. You know, it's like, and some of the things you do, wearing a dress is like the least modest thing you could ever do.
Yeah.
So, and I remember I used to barefoot a lot of the times, couldn't afford a lot of shoes. And so I'd unload hay barefoot and I would have the end of the day, my shins and my calves would just be all scratched up and red and throbbing from being cut all day with it. It was a lot of freedom in that. It was a lot of vulnerability, honestly, because as long as I wore the covering, there's just kind of this protection around you where others, it's good and it's bad. Either you're ignored and seen, or you're seen as like a novelty. And so I wasn't used to people, like if you're in the shopping line, someone talking to me, like people just don't talk to you like you're a person. That's abnormal. Or people would just stare. I remember I asked Aaron about that because he didn't know me my first year. He wasn't there. He came my second year. He said that one of the things that he thought of when he would see people wearing doilies, and I found out from other individuals later who would have known me my first year at the college, is that they thought that you were closed off to dating anyone outside the faith community. Like that would have just been, you know, so you were kind of hands off. So I found out later there were several guys who were probably interested, but because I were just never even bothered.
Were there other people at the school, the college that had doilies too?
There was my one friend who she was a senior by the time I got there. So she moved in different circles. She's why I went to that college particularly. But she moved in different circles. She lived in a different dorm. She was doing her student teaching. So I rarely saw her. And then there was one other, and that's important in my story, the second year. One of them was my RA, and she would wear her her covering her doily when she would go to church. There was a church in Indiana that some of the college people would attend once in a while. And so she would wear hers, a Mennonite one. So she would wear hers to that. It was like a 45-minute drive. But she was my RA. And that really plays into the story because as conservative Mennonites, there's this, we always, people will call it the Mennonite game. So if I know you and you can tell me where you're from or you can tell me, we can probably find a connection. Like it's just either we're related or we know a whole bunch of people they know. It's just like this, it's fun and it's scary. And I know that it makes people feel like outsiders when we do it. So I try not to do it as much anymore. But there's this instant trust that kind of comes with that because you know this community. It's an honest community. When I first started writing poetry, I didn't think I could lie in my poetry. Like I didn't think I could make things up because you always tell the truth. And so, my mom was like, Joyce, when I read one of my poems, she was like, Joyce, that didn't happen to you. I said, I know, Mom, this is called creative writing. And she's like, but why would you write that? That didn't happen to you. So it was just that level of honesty and trust that would immediately be there when you meet someone else from that community. So she was my RA on my floor when I was there. And so I think there were some guys, but the guys don't stand out. That's always been my issue. You never know when the guys, conservative Mennonite or not, they look like everyone else. So they didn't have to deal with that. So my second year, Grace, I had worked the first year and the second year I started again. I worked at the main counter in the library. We also have a seminary. And we had to check backpacks because it was known that seminaries would steal scrolls and other important items. So we would check everyone's pack back before they left. So I got to pretty well know everyone on campus, you know, sooner or later.
Because you're looking through their bags.
I'm looking through their bags and you're making small talk and you're, you know, it's just, and they'd have to, back in the old days when you have to check out books from behind the counter that were put on reserve, DOS floppy disks that you'd have to use in the computer lab. So this is aging me a lot. But I really got to know a lot of the students. I got to know a lot of the professors, seminary professors, their wives, their children would come into the library a lot of times to bring them lunch or whatever. And so I was very comfortable at the college. It was like my second home. I could see someone walking across campus and I might not be able to know their name, but I could place them. I knew who their friends were. I knew kind of who they hung out with. It was just that much of a home to me. So the second year I get there, I'm excited. I'm wearing jeans and they actually finally allowed you to wear jeans in class. That was the first year they allowed that before you had to wear dress pants. So I was wearing jeans to class. I didn't have my covering on. I had some really good friends. We just were having a great time. And one of those friends actually, what we started doing is on the weekends, every once in a while, you'd find this stray freshman somewhere. You know, they just had no place to be. They didn't know what. So we would actually take them out to McDonald's or take them out to Wendy's or just round up a few strays here or there. And we'd take them out. And we'd talk to them. We'd get to know them. We'd try to make them feel welcome. You know, this was our home. This was our group. This was, you know, we wanted you to feel a part of it. And that's honestly how I met Aaron to begin with, is he was a stray dude just sitting in the Philathea in the student lounge on a weekend evening, and he was watching TV all by himself. And so we were like, hey, you know, you want to go to Wendy's? You want to go, you know, and he was like, sure. And so we took him out, and my first thing was I asked him what he was going to major, and he said he was going to seminary. So in my mind, I instantly wrote him off as any kind of potential future mate. that, of course, changed later. But that's how I originally met him. But this was my close friend that we used to do things together. She was in theater. So, you know, I love the theater gang. They're my favorite. And so they're a little bit more creative, you know, they're more radical on campus. Oh, they're a blast. Absolutely love them. And then my roommate, I actually had a roommate. She wasn't the typical feminine roommate, you know, that a lot of my floor was very into dating and the latest fashions and the latest hairstyles. And she wasn't, which I was fit me great because that's like, I wasn't that either because I didn't grow up in it and I didn't have money to do any of this anyway. And so we were fast roommates. The three of us would do a lot of stuff together. And it was just, I was having the time of my life. I want to say, when I look back over my life, and I'll say there's probably 2 6-month period where I have been completely happy. I'm not worried. And I was just enjoying life. And that was one of them. It was just for, like, I'm just enjoying life. I'm away. I'm myself. This is the first year I'm really who I am. I'm not hiding behind some kind of religious facade. My friends were not overly religious or spiritual, which was great, which was fine for me. And it was just, it was a great time. So
I have a question before you get forward. So when you were going through that 6-month period of change, or you were changing, how was your relationship with your parents? Did you see them, or what was that like during that time?
So my mom took it really hard when I left. My dad was not surprised at all. He kind of, as we would joke later, he ruined me for being a Mennonite woman because he treated me like his sons, like I built hay wagons, fixed fence, argued Bible, did all these things with him. And so I was used to kind of, it wasn't within the church, but at home I was used to my brain, my thoughts were equal to any man's within the home. My mother struggled with it. My grandfather really struggled with it. My grandfather cried the first time he saw me. When I cut my hair, because that's also part of 1 Corinthians, when I cut my hair was probably the time that was the hardest for them. And after that, I don't believe anyone brought it up again, but there would be a lot of, there was a lot of guilt associated, used. You know, what is that on your lips? You can't go see your grandfather with that on your lips. My aunt had hair she could step on, and here I was with short hair now. It was just really a struggle.
And what is short hair? I'm just curious, like, what is short hair? Like what you are at right now?
Yes. So my
Which
hair
for
used...
the listeners is long in, in most spaces.
Most spaces. So it used to, it was down below my waist to begin with, before I cut it. To them, it was short. Even a trim was not allowed. But
having like way less layers of clothing and hair, you probably felt like you could fly.
I did. Gravity
has
so
no
free
hold on me.
100%. And putting people who do not put their hair up is what we call it, do not understand. I had carpal tunnel by the time I was 20. Because you're constantly having to put barrettes and things in the back of your head. I am thankful, though, my grandfather's family had several people that were shunned in his family. And he was the youngest. And so it would have been his older brothers and sisters. And so they decided that shunning was no longer an option. They noticed that all it did was cause pain. It never brought anybody back in that community. So I was not shunned. But the guilt of a Mennonite mother was definitely on me. But when I was away, when I was at college now, it was really interesting. So these incoming freshmen, which Aaron would have been one of them, that's all they knew me as. They knew me as someone who did not wear a covering, who wore jeans, who did not look different than anyone else. And it would shock me when somebody would just randomly talk to me. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I don't look different. I'm not looking different anymore. So it was wonderful. I felt free. I was finally myself. But then I was also extremely vulnerable because I'm trying to adjust to this way of being in life where you're no longer different. You're no longer considered this unique thing. And then I'm also finding within the larger community, I came in with a lot of naivety. I came in trusting. I came in open, honest, and I expected the same back. And I found that not to be true. So the second year, I arranged to meet with, I'm not even sure what her title was. I'm going to call her Katie. But Katie was, I think she might have been Dean of Women, but she lived in our dorm. She had a place in our dorm. And she did counseling. Another very important fact to note about this college is my first year still at that college, Dr. Crabb was still teaching. He headed up the Christian counseling degrees and the education. The second year I was there, he was no longer teaching. But this Christian counseling was like the thing on campus. People came from everywhere to get their degrees in this Christian counseling with Larry Crabb. The counseling that I was getting from Katie was very grounded in this Christian counseling, but I didn't know anything different. And so it's the first time I had started speaking about my abuse from the past. So that adds a whole other layer of becoming vulnerable. I'm speaking things that people spend their lives never, ever saying. And I know that when I'm speaking them, even if I'm not in the community, I know that if the community knew I was, that they immediately would have a reaction and like, you need to be quiet. Like, we don't talk about this. Like, I've literally had people say that to me in the last year or two, even when I bring it up. And so it was extremely vulnerable, even in this time of freedom. So I got to know Aaron. It was a friendship at first. And I went on an inner city mission in Cleveland. Down, you know, where the kids would talk about the game they played was how many bullets they could find in the morning. And the one who found the most won. And then I was coming back after that weekend. And I was like, I cannot sit in a church that has all this money when there's kids out here struggling and sit and pretend that everything's okay with the world. So I was like, I'm going to skip church. Which somebody could say that was the beginning of my downfall. I was going to skip church because when I grew up, we attended every Sunday morning. Every other Sunday evening was church. Every other Sunday evening was a youth hymn sing. So every Sunday morning and evening, there was something. Then Wednesday night was prayer meeting. So we were just there whenever the doors opened. So I actually skipped church that Sunday. And I was thinking, I was like, who could I speak to who would understand my thoughts on why I felt the church was so off the mark with how they were doing things. And I thought of Aaron and I'm like, oh, I'll call Aaron. I think he out of everyone I know would get that. And so I called him and he was like, you want to talk about it? I said, yeah, I want to talk about it. And so we went down, they had a lake. We went down by the lake and we spent the day sharing a lot of things. And I started seeing him. I started seeing a depth to him that I had not before. He was being vulnerable with me. He was sharing things. And then that evening, it got pretty late. We had a curfew. Most Christian colleges do. We had kind of kissed and some things. And to understand that this is the first time I'm speaking of my abuse, to understand that I had never, ever kissed anyone, held hands, had an arm, like nothing. So we sat on the swing and I was keeping really close track of time because I wanted to make sure I was back by curfew. I believe it or not, I'm really not a rabble rouser or a rebel. But we sat on the swing and I talked to him about it. And I said, look, you know, I'm starting this counseling. I'm starting this stuff. This is not, I don't want to get into the romance, any kind of physical part with the romance because I need to be able to separate this out so that I can work through my counseling. I like you. I want this to go on. I want to pursue this. This is something I'm interested in. If you have the patience to walk with me, we will get there. But I said, right now, not. And so I was actually pretty proud of myself. For someone who doesn't do boundaries very well, I'm also ADHD. I was pretty proud of myself. I got back in like 2 minutes before curfew. And my roommate was asleep. And there was a knock on the door about five after. And there used to be a lot of people that would come and borrow clothes. I don't know if you ever lived. You probably have no idea about that, what that means as a man. But as a woman, we would borrow clothes constantly. And so I thought, oh, this is someone who wants to come borrow my one blazer. I had great shoulder pads, by the way. And so I did not answer the door because I did not want, my roommate is very upset if somebody wakes her up. So that happened two more times. By the third time, I'm like, I don't know who this is, but they need to stop. So I opened the door and here was my RA, the other Mennonite, on my floor. And she asked why I came in so late. And I said, I didn't. I was in, but I didn't answer the door because I didn't want to make my roommate up. Now, normally, that would have been it, because within our community, we don't lie. It's just we're straight up about stuff like that. And she was someone I trusted. She was from my community. And she said, no, I'm going to write you up. And I was like, what? Like, why are you doing this to me? I don't understand this. Like, I thought we understood each other. I thought we knew what was happening. I told you the truth. If I had come in late, I would have admitted I came in late. But she ended up campusing me, which made me very angry. I have to admit, I felt betrayed by someone within my faith. I felt betrayed by someone that I trusted, and which kind of built upon the betrayal, because all my abusers were people that I knew and trusted. That triggered something in me. And when you're campused, I don't remember all the details, but I think I had to actually stay in my room because I think I had to have permission and you had your food brought to you as like you were sick.
Gosh.
Oh, it's insane. And I think I had permission. I got permission to actually talk to Aaron for just a little bit because I was like, I was in on time. He was like, you left in time to get back to your dorm. Like we had talked about that to make sure I could get back. He was back to his dorm in time. He wasn't late. So we talked for just a little bit that weekend. But the thing that they had, the Monomani Orchestra was in town. And I love the Monomani Orchestra. And so I got special permission to actually attend the Monomani Orchestra with Aaron if I came directly back to my dorm afterwards. So I attended it with him. Great concert, but I was angry. I was triggered because I had gotten campus. Nobody believed me. I was triggered now because somebody was telling me that I can only go to the concert and I can't go anywhere else. And it just, the anger within me was just so huge. I didn't know what to do. So I talked Aaron out of going directly back to the dorm. And we spent some time together. I think it was like maybe 15 minutes, half an hour. It was an hour.
Goodness.
Yeah. So I arrived back at the dorm and our dorm has a lobby. And I walk into the lobby. I'm late because I was out with Aaron. I walk into the lobby and people are immediately telling me, hey, Joyce, your roommate and your best friend are really, really angry with you. Like you might want to still steer clear of them for a while because you didn't come right back from the concert. For them to say that was huge because I'd never seen anger. I'd never seen things like that before. I did know that my one friend, it was around the anniversary of her sister who had taken her life. And so I knew she was kind of on edge, but to know that both of them were angry with me, I felt again betrayed because they should have like asked me because this was not normal Joyce behavior. Like Joyce obeys the rules. Like Joyce doesn't break the rules. So I went upstairs to my room. Nobody was there. And I remember sitting in the bathroom and crying because I did not understand, like, why is everyone angry at me? Why is no one believing me? Like, this is going on now 2 weekends. What is happening? And I'm not sure what happened. I know that my roommate came in and she was angry. I didn't open the door because she was angry. And so she left and I went next door to the neighbor's room. And then I remember having a panic attack. Now, this is my first panic attack ever. I mean, I'd been through some horrible things. I had never had a panic attack. I had cussed out my parents. I had like broken stuff. I had never when anyone was around. I punched things. I had like my normal reaction was anger. And I couldn't do that. And I'm not exactly sure why. But this was my first panic attack. And it was dark. And I just remember huddled up. It was just really intense. And I just wanted things to go away. Like, what had happened to my world? My world had crashed in on me. And I had no idea what was happening. So I'm having a panic attack in my neighbor's room. I know that my roommate comes in. She asked if Aaron did anything to me, which is an important thing. And I'm like, no, he didn't. No, I'm able to get that out.
So I'm in my neighbor's room. The dean's wife shows up. I don't know who she is. She introduces herself as such, talks to me. This is after the panic attack was over. I'm really worn. I'm tired. Talks to me. And I'm like, you know, it was really deep. It was really dark. I felt like I had a choice, you know, kind of to go towards the light and do the right thing or go towards the dark and let the anger win. And a very important thing to note is that every year on this campus, they would hold a spiritual emphasis week. And the week that we had just come through dealt with Frank Peretti's This Present Darkness. So people are seeing demons everywhere. Amazingly, people don't see as many angels as what they're seeing demons. But, you know, everything is being attributed to spiritual warfare. Like, it's just everywhere and really scares me for what I see happening again currently in the world. But I talk with her. I don't make a mention to that. And she's like, okay, everything's fine. But she said that my roommate will not be sleeping with me that night. Well, that's a little odd. Okay, she's angry at me. Needs to cool off. That's whatever. So I sleep that night, wake up the next morning, and have to go down and meet with Katie. She, I believe, is the actual dean of women. She had a role over the women's dorms. She's my counselor. She knows my abuse. So I go down, meet with her, and I'm sitting there, and she tells me that I'm not allowed to speak to Aaron at all. I'm not allowed to speak about anything that happened the night previously at all, or they will kick me out of college. Now, this is a college I have worked really hard to get to. Really
hard. And why? Did they give you any reasoning?
Absolutely no reason why. I had no idea what was going on. And so I think I went and ate with some of my other friends, my guy friends. And they were like, are you okay? And I'm like, no, I'm not, but I'm not allowed to speak about anything. And so I can't tell you what's going on. I came back to my dorm and my neighbor, the other side neighbor, was a prof's daughter. And she was like, this is ridiculous. She goes, I'll call him and then you can talk to Aaron and we'll figure out what's going on. And so she called. I love this. I hope somewhere today she's a lawyer. But she called Aaron and she I got on the line with him. And he told me that my friend had called and accused him of raping, sexually assaulting me, and that I was suicidal. And this is why, which never made sense to me, but this is why my roommate was not staying with me that night. I'm like, if I was suicidal, I think they'd want her to, but, or somebody. But anyway, I found out that he had been accused. And so I go to see Katie again, and I'm like, this did not happen. There's no way this happened. She's like, well, you're not allowed to talk about it. You're not allowed to speak to him. I didn't tell her how I'd found out, but she was like, you're not allowed to speak to him. You're not allowed to say anything to him. And my phone call with him had been really short because, like I said, I usually am a rule follower. And so I just wanted to find out what was happening. So we did get a lot of details. I just found the call had been made accusing him. when I sat with Katie and I'm like, well, this isn't fair. Like, this is not fair. This makes me angry. And I still remember, because it was the oddest response out of all my years of counseling. I've never heard anyone do this. She's like, how angry does it make you? And I'm like, I feel like I could just trash the room. Like, this is just making me so angry. And she goes, well, go ahead. She goes, what's stopping you? Pick that up and throw it. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to get more trouble. It was,
what is happening?
It was like the weirdest Twilight Zone. There was no time. There was nothing told to me as to what was going to happen. I was simply told I had to be quiet. I had to be silent. I wasn't allowed to speak of anything that night. I wasn't allowed to speak to Aaron. And if they found out that I spoke with anyone, I would be immediately kicked out.
That's also just really frustrating because your whole life you weren't allowed to talk about hard things.
Exactly. And
or abuse or anything. So they were taking your voice from you again.
And that is probably what hurt me and re-traumatized me, honestly, again. And this was my counselor. This is the person who I trusted. This is the person who knew how this was going to affect me. And they still did that. I did find out later that, unfortunately, she went on to abuse someone else. So she was an abusive person to begin with. And so that's someone else's story to tell. But she worked. I will say that she did do a group therapy. There were like four of us in it that had been sexually abused as children. And she took advantage of that information. So here I am. I'm not allowed to speak. I'm not allowed to say anything. And I just remember like everything in my body, in my mind, shutting down. I couldn't do papers. I had to call out at the library. I'm like, and they're like, what's going on? You're always dependable. Like, and I'm like, I can't say. My roommate and my best friend are no longer speaking to me. So I'm kind of wandering aimlessly around. I had several of my other friends would call and they'd be like, Joyce, what is wrong? Like, you don't look well. What is wrong? And I'm like, I can't say anything. I'm like, I will get kicked out if I say anything. So I can't say anything. And I think it was 2 or 3 days into it, they finally allowed Aaron and I to sit and talk with a couple who had been from Bob Jones. They were house parents or dorm parents. I don't know what they were. And so here we are being monitored, and I'm finding out the details then of what he's been accused of, that he has to go speak to the dean, that he has to do all these things, everything that had been going on in his dorm. Then finding out that some of my friends who were calling me had heard the accusations against him, but they didn't bring them up. If they had, I probably could have said, no, that didn't happen, but they didn't bring them up. And so it was like on the third day, I think I went and I spoke with the dean and I said, this has not happened. That is not what happened at all. I don't know where all this is coming from. I said, if I had been, I would have said something. Like, I'm speaking now. I found my voice. I would have said something. And I said, that did not happen. And the spiritual stuff that they had accused him being in the occult and all this and that. And I found that came from my best friend. And, you know, I look back and I want to look at it with grace and mercy and understand what she might have been going through that period of time around the anniversary time. But it's really hard for me because she never, when I talked with her the first time we sat and talked, she told me, she said, Joyce, you had about 6 to 7 guys you could have chosen from to date. And you chose the one to date that I wanted. And like, I'm this person who has never dated anyone. I don't know anything about a girl code or any of this. Like, this is all foreign to me. I thought then that's why she was angry at me along with everything else. She did not speak to me the rest of the year. My roommate did. It was just really, really strange. And now looking, I would never do it now, but I was like in shock. I think I spent the rest of the year just in complete shock because I just could not believe this had happened. And I couldn't trust anyone anymore. I couldn't trust my roommate. I couldn't trust my best friend. I couldn't trust my counselor. And so here I am. The only person I have is Aaron. So we're eating all our meals together. We're doing everything together because the only person I know that I can trust is Aaron. And then the whole thing of purity culture kicks in. And to me, having come from a childhood that was filled with sexual abuse the whole way until I was 18, you know, anything that was physical to me was like a major deal, like a really major deal. I feel like in this purity culture, now that I have no choice but to marry Aaron, because it's told that, you know, like you become mentally intertwined, even though you might not even have sex, you know, you're still this, you become so intertwined. And we were, but we were codependent is really what it was. And we had such an unhealthy codependent relationship. In some ways it was wonderful because there are things that I love about him. Some ways it was horrible because I felt I was trapped. Like I had no choice. The people who gave us premarital counseling, one of them was Katie, the one who had betrayed me in the first place. This is my biblical counseling. So this is what we're expected to do. And so we got engaged. I still remember it wasn't. On some level, it was somewhat exciting. On the other level, it wasn't, because this was not my plan. This was not my time plan. Like I had sat on the swing and said, look, we got to take it slow. I know I have stuff to work through. I know that there are things that I need to find myself. I've just stopped wearing the covering. I just stopped wearing dresses. I am coming into myself. I don't know who I am yet completely. And that got cut off. And it made me angry and it made me frustrated and I felt trapped. And so we start this marriage off where I am feeling trapped. I've come through trauma again in the name of religion then, because the purity culture had this whole, you know, when we had our premarital counseling, all that stuff that was in there from the Christian counseling. And I knew it wasn't healthy, but I felt unable to do anything about it. I just felt like here I had finally trusted the world, a Christian world, to actually be myself, to find who I was in. And I just got thrown against the wall and completely re-traumatized again. And it was just at the end of the school year, my one friend who had accused me of taking the only guy she was interested in, I went to say goodbye to her because she had meant a lot to me my first year. And she apologized. And she goes, Joyce, I have been such, and she used some graphic words. And I was like, yeah, you were. You really were. She is the only one that ever did. I had my roommate as my maid of honor. That was another thing I felt trapped into because, so I lived on the floor with a lot of seniors and it's called the ring year. And so they all expect to get engaged that year. And then, you know, you get married and your roommate's always your maid of honor. And so it was just, I again did what was expected of me because I did not have the energy to fight anymore. I had just fought to get hurt. I just fought to leave the covering and the dress. And now I'm just beaten down again. And I just don't have energy to fight. I just don't. And then I went through Christian counseling again then for marriage counseling later because that was free. And that caused more harm too. And so it was like I was completely stripped as an individual of myself. My only identity was in how I related to Aaron. My only identity was, I don't think I ever really found my true identity until we went through a period of separation because we had our first son who is a miracle, who is amazing, wonderful. But we had foxhole years, is what I call them. We have foxhole years dealing with autism and some of the effects. That's why he's such a miracle. He was such a violent child. And so, and he's amazing now. He has like his own story and he's just awesome. I'm so proud of him. We went through these years and then I had sickness where I couldn't walk for 2 years. And it was just, I felt like I never got a break. I never got to discover who I was. And so I can sit here sadly at 55. I'll be 56 on Tuesday, but at 55, and I can say I never fully got to come into my own until I was after, until it was after my 50s. And a lot of that had to deal with how the Christian community dealt with me, what they expected of me, and me being afraid to rock the boat too much because I knew even my voice was rocking the boat. I look back those years. I still have issues fully trusting women. I just, it just took the earth right out under my feet with that. I do have a really good friend now, but there's still a part of me that always has this little wall. And I don't think that'll ever go away. There's this little wall where I just literally do not trust anyone because I couldn't trust anyone growing up in my, till I was an adult. Then when I became an adult, I came into this Christian place, this place that was like home to me. This was like my new family. This was like, you know, the new beginning. And yet it happened all over again. And I hate to see the rise of the spiritual warfare stuff again. It's used as a weapon against people. I don't see it doing any good. There's just so many things that, I look back and I wonder how I ever walked out of the fires. And I don't want anyone else to ever have to go through that. Because people can say, well, look, that was X amount of years ago. You should be over that. It affected my ability to parent. It affected my ability to work. It affected so many aspects of my life. And it's not something, especially then when you seek Christian counseling, you end up having to take responsibility for trauma that was done to you. It just compounds things and it just, it's such a setback and it adds layers of trauma on top of trauma you've already gone through. I'm thankful to say I did have a really good counselor later on. I got in on the ground floor of EMDR. And after I did EMDR, I found freedom again. And that's when I started to rediscover myself. But it was in the year, Aaron and I were separated for a year. It was in that year that I also then, everyone uses the term now, deconstructed. But it was in that year that I was like, I need to find a kind and loving God. I am tired of this vengeful God, this God that holds shame against people when it's not their shame to hold, all these other things. And that's when I started just really peeling back the layers and finding out where is this God that I hear about, but I never see. And I really am thankful because I found this God for me was in the traditions of the minorities, the BIPOC individuals, the ones who had to find joy within the fire. They didn't have anything but the fire. And it's with that that I was able to say, this is a God who meets me in the fire. This is a God who does not heap more fire upon me. I was extremely thankful for that. It took a lot of removing myself. It took a lot of trying to find my voice again. There's still, of course, abuse is still happening. Sadly, it will continue to happen. And every time I speak up on it or out on it, it never fails. I have individuals contact me, Joyce, stop, stop. You're bringing shame. You're doing, and it's like, no, can you please put the shame on the perpetrator where it really belongs? Because you even saying that is making the survivors feel shame instead of supported. So I am thankful that I have been able, for me, to walk with a lot of survivors, many of them through childhood sexual abuse. For me, in order to understand where they're coming from, to understand how their voices are taken from them, and say, this is, and speak truth into them, this is not your shame to carry at all. And then be able to walk with them into adulthood. Not everyone finds purpose to their suffering. I don't want to pretend that's something everyone should look for. I mean, I think that's kind of a prosperity gospel thing, honestly. Sometimes it's just suffering, and there's no explanation. There's no good that comes out of it. But for me to be able to do that, I feel like it has somewhat, I don't want to say redeemed, but it has somewhat given life back into parts of my life that have been dead and gone. And so it takes the cobwebs out, it puts a little fire in, and it helps to bring back life for me, because I understand now how to give life to some others. But the whole concept of the time that I was at college, where the people that I trusted, the Christian counselor that I trusted, all these individuals silenced me, threatened me if I broke my silence with something I worked very hard to get, left a permanent, it's one thing when the world does it to you. What do you expect? Of course they're going to do that. No big deal. It's different when you see God in the people who are ministering to you and they do things like that. So it was really hard. Aaron and I went through a lot of years of codependent relationship. It was not pretty. I'm very thankful that we found healing. I'm thankful we found closure. I'm thankful that we have found a new way of being. We have actually gotten now what I wanted clear back when I talked on the swing with him, like 30 some years ago. I wanted to be a whole person. I wanted him to be a whole person. And I wanted us, without any pressure, to decide that we were going to partner together to take on this life. I'm very thankful for that. I think that is something I have been given that is not promised at all to everyone. So I recognize that privilege. And I am just extremely thankful for that. And I'm thankful to be able to speak on these things, because sadly, Christian counseling has not gone away. Abuse has not gone away. The way churches deal, or religious organizations deal, with spiritual warfare has not gone away. It's just like we're in this cycle that just keeps getting repeating. And if it can help one person, just one person, to understand this is not how it was meant to be. This is not how it was meant to be. I need to look for something different, then it's all worth it. Or if one person feels I'm not alone in this, like I'm not at the point where I can do anything about this right now. Because there is a point where you are beaten so low, you literally cannot lift your own head up. If one person can say, I'm not alone in this, someone else went through this, they survived, and now they're thriving, I can hold on to that hope until I can get to the point where I can do something about this. That really makes it all worth it to me.
Wow. That was breathtaking, honestly. I mean, what strength and wisdom in your words. And I mean, it's going to stay with me when you said, I can't believe I made it through the fire. I mean, that's, I'm speechless. And I'm sorry for what you went through, but your story, your relationship with Aaron, like it's such a testament of what God's good work is in individuals and together. And it's just a testament to the beauty and what God can do in our human, while we're here on earth, in our human condition. And, you know, you spoke so much wisdom there about these cycles that we go through. And I just would encourage everyone to hear that, because, you know, all of these cycles we see right now with spiritual warfare and how we're using those terms, it does cause so much harm. And again, this is my opinion. It's super uninformed, and it's super based in a tradition that we have created in this country. It is not based anywhere else. So I think that wisdom is just profound and beautiful. But Joyce, you have left me speechless. John, I don't have anything to say. I mean, the story was amazing.
I also feel speechless, but something that I was just thinking about as you were talking at the end there is how cool it is. Cool seems like a very small word for how I feel, but it's really wondrous to watch you use this voice that you have right now with so much confidence and authority and wisdom, and just what a gift it is to be able to bear witness to that. And it's just, it's an honor. Like, I'm so glad that you did not lose that, and that you've been able to gain that back, and you're using it today. And even as you were telling your story throughout it, I was like, oh, dang, you just had too much fire in you. Like, there was no way. You're sitting around the table with your dad debating the Bible. You know, it's like you had this fire, and it feels like so many people will relate to having that fire, and you're taught that that's wrong. Like, that's a part of you that shouldn't be there. It's a sin. That fire in you is sin. And watching you today, I'm like, that fire is how God created you. And it's beautiful. And like, let's throw some gas on that. I want to see more of that fire. It's just been, it's been really profound to get to watch you speak today. And I don't have a lot of words. I witnessed you throughout my short time on Twitter the last couple years, and seen you speak up when you need to, honestly. And you add so much wisdom and nuance every time I see you in any conversation. I truly just feel so honored to be able to partner with you in this way and to help shoulder your story a little bit in this space. And I hope, I mean, I'm thinking through, you're speaking out, so inevitably someone might come talk to you and tell you to stop talking, and you're bringing shame. And there's this part of me that wants to say, like, that shame that you're feeling is not because Joyce is speaking out. That shame that you're feeling is because you're not.
Yeah.
So sit with that tension. Maybe the shame you're feeling is the fact that you're carrying those secrets, and you're sitting with the fact that you know people are being harmed. You know kids are being harmed, and you're not in a safe enough place to say something yourself. But I'm proud of you, Joyce, that you have broken free, and that you're using your voice to speak up for people that have been told that they don't have a voice to do it themselves.
Thank you. It's and I, of course, I watched Women Talking, and I've been watching it piece by piece at home while it's on streaming, processing it, because so many of the plain things, like my mother grew up with her hair being tied, braided with a string because it helps stay. And the one thing I've done, not only my voice, but I've started recording Zooms with my mom, and I'm having her tell her story of what it was like to grow up, her story of, and I want it, people to understand that this is a generational thing. It affects what we don't deal with in one generation affects the next, whether directly or indirectly. And so to speak up is not only to give voice to yourself, it's to give hope for the future generation. And in the Women Talking, the thing that I like is that the women leave. I don't know if I'm supposed to say movie spoiler, like, but anyway, the women leave and it's heart-wrenching. And she says, I don't have the exact words in front of me, but she says, basically, your story is not my story. She's telling her child. And the women leave with the song Near My God to me. It's like they're getting nearer as they're leaving the trappings behind. And then there's rain. And it's like this cleansing rain. And then the children start singing Near My God to me. And it's because the voice that is used now in this generation is like a pebble thrown into the pond. It doesn't just sink. It creates ripples. And in only doing that, are we going to set others free? And I'm thankful my children are free. My boys are free. I wish I could have maybe done it in a healthier way with me being a little healthier, but my boys are free. They're ready to change the world. They're ready to take on the world and say, this is wrong. This is not right. And they're free. But so many others are being silenced. There is a time just to rest in that cleft of the rock. There is a time when you literally are trapped and you cannot move. You cannot, even your thoughts feel like they're going to overwhelm you because they feel as if they're so wrong. Like you've been told for so long and allowed to think these things. And there's a time for that. There's a time to be in that cleft of the rock for your safety, for safety for your soul. But once that time has passed, there's a time to speak because it's not just for you, your generation. We need to set our children free. We need to set the future generations free instead of keep binding them in the same chains and bars that we ourselves were bound in. A lot of people will diss social media. I am just so excited for social media. I came to scream into the void of Twitter, and I found other survivors as I was talking with Krista this morning. And it was like, I'm not alone. What I'm thinking, what I'm saying is okay. And there's strength in numbers. So if I can be just a little number in someone's head somewhere to let them know, just let them know they're not alone. Their thoughts are okay. To think this way, and then maybe later when you have energy and ability to take action, you can do that just to let you know you're not alone and it's okay.
So beautiful. You mentioned being like a pebble in the water. I think something profound and beautiful about social media for all its faults is when you have a bunch of pebbles in the water, it's like throwing a giant boulder in the water. And that is the goal, right? Yes. That's why we're all here 100%. Doing this right now.
Yes, totally.
You can maybe try to ignore a pebble, but you can't ignore this giant boulder
right.
that we are collectively lobbing right now.
The mob.
Yes. Yeah. This is when the mob quote is a good
unquote.
Thing.
Yes, yeah, quote unquote. Yeah. But yeah, there's strength in numbers. And so if they're scared, then that's really their problem, not ours. Whatever. Yes. Yes, 100%. And that is, to me, to use their terminology in my way, that is spiritual warfare, is breaking the bonds of silence, breaking the bonds of submission, breaking the bond, unhealthy submission, breaking those bonds that tie people. Because we used to always end church, a lot of times we'd end church with singing, "Blessed be the tie that binds." I don't know if you're familiar with that hymn or not. And I was like, oh, yeah, sometimes that's good. And sometimes that's really, really bad. And so the thing is to recognize what are the good ties that bind us together. That's love. That's concern for each other. That's support. But we need to break those bad ties of silence, of those other things that bind us well, to find freedom.
And this is where we find ourselves, scattered across the plains and valleys. Into the streets of chaos, we have traveled alone. An exploration to explain our sadness with doctrine. We have entered those halls, searching for any answer that quiets the doubts that keep us awake. In those sleepless nights, we drift outside our body to find a place where our soul cannot be lost. At war with our emotions that keep pulling us in, a prophetic discouragement that will not allow you to rest. I long to find a town where I can wander free. In the streets of Jubilee, with my hands towards the night sky, I can feel myself aware of who I am and loving who I was. This certainty is what I search for. It is why I write and why I create. I dream of this for you, for me, for all of us. Not in buildings or rituals or in text, but in the abundance of connection and love, where all belong and all can stay. For Jay Coyle, I'm Jonna Harris, and this has been the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed here are the speaker's own and not those of this podcast. This content is presented for informational and educational purposes that constitute fair use, commentary, or criticism. While we make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, we welcome any comment, suggestion, or correction of errors.